My name is Francis Boyle. I'm professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law in Champaign. I joined the faculty here in 1978. Before that, I studied at Harvard. I have a JD magna cum laude from Harvard Law School and an AM and PhD in political science from Harvard, specializing in international relations and its relationship to international law and international organizations. I've published 5 books and, I don't know, maybe 60 articles, something like that.
I want to ask you about the legality of the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan and begin with asking you if you can tell me about the evidence the U.S. presented to justify its attacks.
Well, originally, Secretary of State Colin Powell promised the American people a white paper outlining what their evidence would be. He was promptly overruled by President Bush. So all we got was an interview he gave Secretary Powell with the New York Times, in which he said that the so-called evidence was not even circumstantial. Well, if it's not even circumstantial, then it is not really evidence. It's insinuation, rumor, innuendo, allegation. The New York Times for the same day also reported that when a U.S. ambassador was sent over to brief the NATO states on the evidence, that the U.S. ambassador produced nothing new and indeed no evidence that Mr. bin Laden himself or his organization were behind the attack of September 11th or that the government of Afghanistan had anything to do with it. The best we got was then a white paper by Tony Blair. Well, no one here in the United States has voted for Tony Blair, so I don't think we should take his word for it. But in any event, even the British government conceded that the white paper, which I did read, would not stand up in court, and it was almost universally derided in the mainstream British news media. So right now, we really don't have whatever the evidence might be, and indeed, steps have been taken to make sure we don't get the evidence. What is really called for here is a special committee impaneled by Congress with subpoena powers and the ability to put people under oath subject to perjury and to call upon any agency or organization in the government to find out what evidence they have, and also how did this happen on September 11th. But we note from the public record that apparently that has been sidetracked, and I don't think we are really going to get to the bottom of who ultimately was behind the events of September 11th. And why, despite all the signposts that were out there prior to September 11th that something was going to happen, that U.S. investigative agencies and intelligence agencies were not able to prevent it.
Okay, now, the World Court has ruled that a state can be found guilty on the basis of circumstantial evidence, provided there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Do we have that proof in this case?
Yes, this is the very famous Corfu Channel case decided by the World Court, ruling that, yes, a government can be found guilty on mere circumstantial evidence, provided there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But even here, in this case, I don't believe government decision-makers have to necessarily operate on proof behind a reasonable doubt. But it does seem to me we need the lesser standard here of clear and compelling evidence. And the lowest standard is circumstantial case, which Secretary Powell said we don't even have here. He's admitted that. So that if I were to go to the World Court and file that statement, his admission would be deemed an admission against interest, that as of the date he made his statement, we did not even have a circumstantial case against bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and Afghanistan. So it seems to me that that is the way the Muslim world sees it, 1.2 billion people, 56 countries, and now that is the way a good deal of Europe is seeing it, that the evidence simply has not been produced to justify this war against Afghanistan.
A lot of people are calling what happened terrorism, and I'm wondering if you can tell us, under international law and practice, is there an accepted definition for terrorism?
Yes, the situation is a bit complicated, so bear with me for a minute. Under international law and practice, there is not a formal definition of terrorism that is generally accepted. However, under United States domestic laws and statutes, we do have a definition of terrorism for the purpose of United States law. And clearly what happened in New York and Washington on September 11 would qualify as acts of terrorism under United States statutes. And indeed, in the first statement he made to the news media, President Bush correctly called these acts of terrorism. But within 24 hours, he consulted with Secretary Powell, and all of a sudden the rhetoric changed, and they began to call it an act of war, and trying to analogize it to Pearl Harbor. There are very significant differences about how you deal with acts of terrorism as opposed to acts of war. An act of terrorism you deal with as a matter of domestic and international law enforcement. And this is, by the way, what happened in the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. These were dealt with as matters of law enforcement. And here, the United Nations organization, the Ad Hoc Committee on International Terrorism, has, over the past 25 years now, elaborated 12 or 13 international conventions specifically designed to deal with certain aspects of what people generally would call terrorism. Now, I won't go through all these conventions here, but there is one convention directly on point, the Montreal Sabotage Convention. Both the United States and Afghanistan are parties to this convention. About 171 states in the world community are parties. It does specifically define destruction of civilian aircraft as a violation of the convention. And it has an entire legal framework and mechanism to deal with all possible disputes arising out of this situation, up to and including access to the International Court of Justice to resolve any disputes that cannot be resolved by the parties to the convention. And it seemed to me that certainly this was the better way to handle the situation rather than escalating the rhetoric and the stakes by calling this an act of war. And as a matter of fact, this is exactly the way the situation was dealt with in the bombing of the Pan Am jet over Lockerbie, Scotland, in the dispute between Libya on the one hand and the United States and the United Kingdom on the other hand. There was grave loss of life. The Montreal Sabotage Convention was invoked. There were proceedings at the International Court of Justice. In fact, they're still pending. Eventually, a tribunal, a criminal tribunal, ad hoc criminal tribunal, was set up in The Hague to adjudicate allegations against the two Libyan individuals accused by the U.S. and the U.K. One of them was acquitted, one was convicted, and that conviction is currently on appeal. So there is a precedent here for dealing with this precise same problem. I admit that the deaths here, we're now seeing the death estimate reduced to about 2,600, is significantly more, certainly, than what happened at Lockerbie or the Murrah Federal Building. But the principle is the same. It should have, in my opinion, be treated as an act of terrorism under U.S. law and in accordance with the standard operating procedures, treaties, conventions of domestic and international law enforcement.
After September 11th, the current administration approached the UN Security Council. What were the results on that?
My reading of the Security Council resolution that they did get on September 12th, they acted on the assumption that this was an act of war and not an act of terrorism. And the Security Council did not accept that characterization. They called these terrorist attacks, which has a meaning, as opposed to an armed attack. An armed attack would mean an act of war. An armed attack by one state, nation state, against another nation state. It seems to me, in reading that resolution, that President Bush Jr. tried to get a Security Council resolution along the same lines that his father got, President Bush Sr., during the Gulf confrontation with Iraq over Kuwait. And President Bush Sr., November 29, 1990, asked for and got a resolution from the Security Council authorizing the use of military force for the purpose of expelling Iraq from Kuwait. He actually asked for language that would use the words military force. China objected, and so they used the euphemism, quote, by all necessary means, unquote. But everyone knew that basically was an authorization to use military force. By comparison, my reading of the Security Council resolution gotten by President Bush Jr., he asked for it and he didn't get it. He received no authorization from the Security Council to use military force. He then tried a second time on September 29 and again failed, did not get authorization to use military force. So when that happened, again, unlike his father, who did try and succeeded, he commenced the bombing campaign against Afghanistan without Security Council authorization, and then had the new U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Negroponte, who we all know from his orchestration of the war against Nicaragua, send a letter to the Security Council and saying, well, we're exercising our right of self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter, and we reserve our right to use force in self-defense against other states as we see fit. It was really an extraordinary letter. So in the absence of Security Council authorization, the best Bush Jr. could do was to fall back on self-defense argument. But of course, what we're doing in Afghanistan is not self-defense, let's be honest. This is retaliation, vengeance, bloodlust, catharsis, call it what you want. Clearly, retaliation is not self-defense. It's the same principle at stake in domestic law as in international law. Someone's actually trying to kill you, then of course you can defend yourself. But if someone tries to kill you, fails, that doesn't give you the right then to go back to your home, get a gun, and go searching around for the guy and killing him. You're supposed to go to the sheriff. The same principle is at work here. The sheriff is the Security Council. And again, President Bush Jr., unlike President Bush Sr., failed on two separate occasions at least to get that authorization, and it does not appear that he at this point is going to bother. And this has created a serious problem around the world. Certainly, again, in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, everyone is saying, well, first, there are no facts they've produced, and second, Bush Jr., unlike Bush Sr., does not have authorization from the Security Council to use military force against Afghanistan. Bush Sr., on the basis of that Security Council resolution, was indeed able to put together a coalition of states. Bush Jr., however, has no coalition. Basically, right now, the only states using force are the United States and the United Kingdom. Canada and Australia have also agreed to get involved. But how does that look? You basically see four white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, colonial, imperial states blowing up a impoverished third world Muslim state. That's how this is looking now around the world. So there's a major difference here between the legal basis that President Bush Sr. had as opposed to President Bush Jr. Second, President Bush Sr. then took his Security Council resolution to the United States Congress and got what is called war powers authorization to use force. Under the 1973 War Powers Resolution passed over President Nixon's veto for the purpose of preventing another Vietnam War. The resolution that President Bush Sr. got from the United States Congress was very limited. It was precisely limited to carry out the terms of the Security Council resolution he had gotten in late November, which meant he had authorization from the Security Council and the United States Congress to expel Iraq from Kuwait, but that was it. And indeed, as you know, he did expel Iraq from Kuwait. They drove the Iraqi army north and stopped the war south of Basra, north of the border, but south of Basra, taking the position, this is all the authority I had under international law and United States constitutional law. Now, he was criticized for that, but the point is, he had no authority to march on Baghdad or anything at all of that nature. What happened here with President Bush Jr., when he failed to get his Security Council authorization, he then went into Congress on September 14, the U.S. Congress, and got war powers authorization resolution, but it is completely open-ended, unlike the one his father got. Congress basically gave him authority to wage war, use military force against any state, organization, or individual that he alleges alone was somehow involved in the tragic events of September 11, or aided and abetted, or harbored, or gave sanctuary to these individuals. Now, at that point in time, the Bush administration, Bush Jr., were saying, well, that could be upwards of 60 states. This resolution that Bush Jr. got from Congress on September 14 was far worse than the Tonkin Gulf resolution that President Johnson got from Congress that he then used to justify the massive escalation of U.S. military involvement in Vietnam up to the point that at one point there were 500,000 U.S. troops in Vietnam. This is a very dangerous resolution that President Bush Jr. got from Congress. In addition, he also got a $40 billion appropriation to wage war, as he sees fit, the first installment, and Congress has apparently promised him they are prepared to give him more. So this is a very dangerous situation.
Jumping back to Article 51 that Negroponte presented to the United Nations, can you think of any other precedent for the position put forth by Negroponte that the U.S. reserves the right to go to war in self-defense against unspecified numbers of other states whenever we see fit?
Well, the one precedent there is, which is not very favorable, goes back to the Nuremberg prosecutions of the Nazi war criminals in 1945-1946. Where the, not to get too technical here, if you want I can get more technical, where basically the defendants and their lawyers were arguing that the entire Second World War was not a war of aggression, but rather a war of self-defense as determined by themselves exclusively, and that no one else had a right to determine what was necessary for their self-defense. The Nuremberg Tribunal considered this argument and rejected it and ruled that what is self-defense can only be determined by reference to international law, and that one state alone does not have the right to decide for itself what is necessary for its own self-defense, but that international institutions and tribunals do indeed have a right and an obligation to make those determinations in accordance with the rules of international law.
Talk about negotiations to turn over bin Laden that have been going on between the U.S. and Afghanistan dating back before September 11th.
Yes, there was just a recent article in the Washington Post on this, documenting this at great length, and there were other sources publicly available from the region that you could follow if you were carefully following it. Negotiations had been going on between the United States and the government of Afghanistan, and indeed, the United Nations Charter clearly requires negotiations. The Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, the Paris Peace Pact, to which the U.S. and Afghanistan are also parties, requires negotiations. To make a long story short, in these negotiations, again, according to published sources I've read, the United States insisted that the government of Afghanistan turn over bin Laden to the United States because of the allegations that he was behind the bombings in Africa, the U.S. embassies in Africa. The government of Afghanistan first said, one, you have to produce evidence to us, which we never did. We just made an ultimatum. Second, we cannot turn him over to you because we do not believe he will get a fair trial in the United States, which certainly is a reasonable position to take. We are prepared, however, to have him tried before some Islamic tribunal consisting of Islamic judges and administering the Islamic law of Sharia. But you are still going to have to give us the evidence. All that was rejected by the United States, and we still insisted that he must be turned over to the United States. This pattern is very similar to the Lockerbie situation, where the U.S. and the U.K. demanded that the two Libyan nationals must be turned over to them unconditionally. And what happened, again, to make a long story short, in February of 1998, the International Court of Justice issued a judgment overwhelmingly rejecting contentions by the United States and the United Kingdom, whereupon they realized they were going to lose the whole case at the end of the day, and they finally came up with a compromise proposal that this ad hoc tribunal would be established in The Hague, and the two Libyan nationals would surrender to the tribunal in The Hague for the trial. And eventually that proved to be acceptable to the two Libyan nationals and their lawyer. Of course, the United States and the United Kingdom could have had these guys many years before, because Libya had made repeated offers for a trial in a neutral venue, all of which were rejected by the U.S. and the U.K. So again, we see a similar pattern here. The government of Afghanistan saying, okay, we're willing for a trial, some type of neutral venue, and the U.S. saying, no, you have to give them to us, and we're not even going to give you our evidence. Now, after September 11th, there was a change in the position of the government of Afghanistan, and they stated, okay, we are prepared to hand him over to a tribunal in a neutral location. It does not have to consist of all Muslim judges. We would like one Muslim judge on the panel. And they do not have to be administering the Islamic code of Sharia, but we still want to see the evidence you have against bin Laden. President Bush, in his address to Congress, just rejected that out of hand. There were never any negotiations on it. And finally, the government of Afghanistan took the position, we would be prepared to try him ourselves under our own law, but again, you are still going to have to give us the evidence of his guilt that you have. And again, President Bush responded by saying, there'll be no negotiations, we're not going to give you anything, you just turn him over to us. Well, again, the Montreal Sabotage Convention has a requirement that you have to produce evidence. And then at that point, the government, with the control of the accused individual, either has to prosecute him themselves or extradite him to another state with jurisdiction to prosecute him. So, again, it does not seem to me that the Bush administration was adhering to the requirements of the Montreal Sabotage Convention. It does not seem to me that they made any effort after September 11 to negotiate anything as required by the United Nations Charter and the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Rather, they simply issued an ultimatum.
And the Montreal Sabotage Convention, the UN, and the Kellogg-Briand Pact, are both the U.S. and Afghanistan signatories to those?
To all three, yes. There are other conventions out there that potentially are applicable to this situation, but those three are, I think, the most important in establishing what are the respective rights of the two states involved.
Do you think there's anyone in the Bush administration that was actually pushing for following international law on this, or are they just totally devoid of anyone in there with respect to that?
I really can't say. I do know that I did give some interviews and point out that there is also the United Nations Terrorist Bombing Convention that is directly on point here, dealing with terrorist bombings. But unfortunately, although President Clinton signed it, it's been sitting over in the Senate for a while. They haven't done anything about it. And I made a recommendation we should ratify it right away and proceed to encourage ratification by other states, and again use that convention together with the Montreal Sabotage Convention to deal with these allegations as a matter of international law enforcement. And I did notice then several days later, President Bush did call, after I made this suggestion, he did call for the Senate to ratify the terrorist bombing convention. So obviously there's someone over there in the State Department who is aware of these conventions. But I have not yet seen any statement coming out of the United States government on the Montreal Sabotage Convention, or really any indication at all that they are prepared to use the well-established mechanisms of international law to resolve this dispute. It does seem to me they want a war, and they have their war.
So then what's your theory about why they want this war? Why are we over there bombing?
I think it's very clear if you've been following, especially the pages of the Wall Street Journal, for the past decade, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the discovery of massive oil and natural gas sources in Central Asia, both the United States and U.S. oil companies have moved heaven and earth to get access to the Central Asian energy fields. You saw writings in the Wall Street Journal, former U.S. government officials saying, you know, getting access to these energy resources is now a vital national interest of the United States. Well, it hadn't been before, but now all of a sudden it is. And we proceeded to set up military cooperation arrangements with several of these Central Asian states during the past decade. The Partnership for Peace, U.S. Special Forces were over there training military forces, cooperative arrangements and relationships, even military exercises. At one point several years ago, you had the 82nd Airborne parachuting into Kazakhstan. We also know that the U.S. oil company Unocal had been negotiating with the government of Afghanistan to construct oil and gas pipelines out of Central Asia, down through Afghanistan, Pakistan, and then into the Arabian Sea or in India. So all that had been in the works for quite some time. And it seems to me that this is the real agenda here. By the way, if you read today's New York Times, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld has indicated that the Pentagon will attempt to get base access rights to other Central Asian states beyond Uzbekistan. We already now have a commitment from Uzbekistan for the deployment of troops. They've indicated they're going to increase that deployment, and they have also indicated they're going to try to get deployments of U.S. troops in other Central Asian states. This is the exact same pattern that happened during the Gulf War under Bush Sr., where we used that war as justification to deploy 20,000 U.S. forces in all these Gulf states where they still sit today, and to establish a separate fleet, the 5th Fleet, now headquartered in Bahrain. So now, 10 years after the conclusion of the Gulf War, and putting aside even before the events of September 11, we basically were in de facto occupation of the Gulf oil fields and policing it with a separate fleet. And that all happened under Bush Sr. Under Bush Jr. now, it's pretty much the same cast of characters, only different chairs. Cheney's there, Powell's there. Many of the same people who were there the last time are back in again under Bush Jr., and they are now making a grab for the natural gas and oil resources of Central Asia, which are publicly reported to be second only to those of the Persian Gulf, which we also control and dominate.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that Donald Rumsfeld is negotiating a agreement with Uzbekistan.
That's already been negotiated, and indeed it was in the works for quite some time. Rumsfeld went over there, met with their dictator Karimov, who's been condemned by human rights organizations for massive violations of his own people, and then announced that the United States will guarantee the security of Uzbekistan. Well, the problem with that is that Rumsfeld has no authority to guarantee anyone's security. That can only be done by Congress by means of a treaty and a statute of Congress. But it does appear that was in the works, and indeed the public sources indicate that the United States is negotiating with Uzbekistan over what is known as a status of forces agreement. I won't get into all that, but a status of forces agreement permits the long-term deployment of U.S. armed forces in another country. We have status of forces agreements today, for example, with Germany, Japan, and South Korea. And we've had troops in there since the end of the Second World War. So it seems to me we are planning for a very long-term deployment to Uzbekistan, and then we'll take whatever we can get in any of the surrounding Central Asian states.
Let me conclude with asking you, what do you see as a reasonable course that the U.S. should take now to end this madness?
We have to stop the bombing immediately. It is only killing large numbers of innocent civilians in Afghanistan, as have all repeated U.S. bombing campaigns going back to the Vietnam War. So first, the bombing must halt. Second, we have to sit down with the government of Afghanistan, as we are required to do by the United Nations Charter and the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and try to negotiate out the sources of disagreement that we do have with them, that we are alleged to have with them over Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and whatever else we disagree with them about. But again, I'm suggesting here that isn't the real agenda. The real agenda is the military deployment to Central Asia and access to the oil and gas and building a pipeline. And if we want to prevent that and stop this war, then it's really up to the American people to exercise their First Amendment rights to stop this war. Freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, petition the government for redress of grievances. I think that that is the only thing that is going to be able to stop this, that the American people have to indicate, and we're starting to see now a shift in American public opinion. It has already happened in Europe, where public opinion in Europe has turned against the bombing campaign, and it's slowly happening here in the United States. That process has to be accelerated. People must be educated, and then they must pressure the government, the Bush administration, and Congress to stop the bombing campaign and to sit down and attempt to negotiate a reasonable settlement of this problem. Otherwise, I'm afraid the situation might get completely out of anyone's control, and you could see a major regional war over there, perhaps between Pakistan and India, that could easily go nuclear. So again, I think it's really up to the American people to pressure the Bush administration and Congress to use our First Amendment rights and stop the bombing and demand that there be negotiations.